This week, civil rights leaders rallied in Washington.
60 years after the March on Washington for jobs and freedom, we are at a very challenging and difficult time.
U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo visits Beijing as part of efforts to strengthen communications.
All of the meetings were productive, I'm happy to report. In the meetings, we had candid, open conversations.
And the children's advocacy organization Save the Children says casualties in Ukraine have increased over the past 4 months. Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. Hello, I'm Kim Lewis. Thousands of people converged on the National Mall for the 60th anniversary of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Washington this past Saturday to remember Dr. King's famous I Have a Dream speech and to remind Americans that racial equality has yet to fulfill his dream. Among those participating in the event was the late civil rights leader's son, Martin Luther King III.
60 years after the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, we are at a very challenging and difficult time. This is a very difficult day for us in one sense, because you would think that America would be much further than it is. What we know, though, is that Mom and Dad and others taught us that when people come together, change can occur. We will never give in. We will never give out. We will never give up. We must work to realize the dream.
Nicole Ondahl is Senior Vice President for People and Culture at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She spoke with me about race relations in America today.
The heart of healthy race relations lies in the ability of different racial groups not to just live together without general friction, but to understand and respect one another. And that, I believe, is something that is really the thread that carries through a lot of what he had to say. I would say since we lost him and in the last several decades, we have seen exponential improvement in this regard. We used to ignore, you know, our parts of identity and culture and history, and those things have now become part of the public discourse. Blacks and whites and other racial groups, we do live and work in closer proximity, but the racial gap in education is still growing. And I was just recently also reading about his Poor People's Campaign as well. So poverty is a big issue, and stereotyping and polarization is still prevalent between various groups. You know, what I see is, unfortunately, some figures use their bully pulpit to capitalize on these misperceptions and misrepresentations in order to further their own political or economic gains. And even worse are when we have events like Jacksonville, Buffalo, and Charlottesville, which are nothing new in our history. But, you know, it's important to remember that the shooter in Jacksonville may have acted alone. He was part of a group of individuals, a growing group of individuals, I might add, for whom just distrust and hatred isn't enough. They use, you know, large-scale public acts of violence to foment racial division and promote their hate. You know, we really have to keep laser focused on making sure we continue to foster that understanding, embrace differences, and acknowledge history, even when, you know, parts of history make us uncomfortable.
Many say, well, we have made progress. It seems like here in America, maybe going backwards in time rather than moving ahead. So What is the root action that needs to be taken to improve racial equality in America?
There's so many areas where that improvement needs to be had. You know, I could just go down the list of everything from housing, you know, education access, public works. But I'm going to go back to kind of this principle that I like to talk about and think about honestly in discussions with people on this very problem. And the heart is that despite what many people want to believe, it is not enough just to put your head down and work hard to get ahead here or anywhere else. I mean, they're both key components to success, but you're not going to get anywhere if the opportunity is there. You know, there's just a lack of equality amongst public school systems. In some communities, that quality varies from school to school. You know, your communities are blighted by a lack of resources or safe housing. You have food deserts where people can't have a regular access to food. There's lack of public transportation. There's the cycle of poverty that traps so many families and communities. So if we're going to improve racial inequality, we have to have awareness and acknowledge that bias still exists. We are not past this problem. It is still very much part of where we are. So acknowledging that and working from that instead of trying to, you know, act like it doesn't exist or we've somehow, you know, transcended. Discrimination casts a very long shadow. You look over your shoulder, it's still there, but you're also touching it and feeling it every day. So being able to acknowledge that history, but also what's happening right now is very important.
I also wanted to touch on a part of Martin Luther King's speech, which included equality for women. How have women advanced over the years, and how can women be a role model for women in developing countries?
Women have certainly advanced in many ways really quickly, at least in the professional space, you know, just since, you know, the last few decades. You now have more women graduating with law degrees than men. You have more women getting advanced degrees. You see, you know, women's role in the home has continued to change. But there's still areas where, you know, even for women, that inequality is still there. You saw the pandemic had a profound impact on women empowerment, with women, you know, dropping out of the workforce and now trying to get back in. But again, I think that's another area where you can say lots of progress has been made, but we're still held back in some ways. So, you know, continuing to, you know, lead with your nose, push for improvements there, I think is vital. You know, as for how women can be a role model, I think there are many exceptional women leaders across the globe, including in developing countries. The State Department recently had a program where they gave awards to folks that have worked across the globe against racism, and the majority of the leaders on that stage were women from all over the world, including the developing world. So I think women in those countries should serve as the role models to leaders, you know, in the U.S. I mean, I think oftentimes we think of ourselves as the leader in this space, but we can look to others' leadership as well. And they should also serve as the role models to each other. You know, we can serve as a hub to bring everybody together, but we shouldn't be driving this dialogue. Women can work collaboratively, and then everyone bringing their own experiences and expertise to the fore. You know, women aren't a monolith, so bringing all these diversity of experiences and ideas together to be mutually beneficial and to learn from one another and amplify and prop each other up where necessary, I think is really important.
And I just wanted to go back on the recent incident that occurred over the weekend of the killing of three African Americans in Jacksonville, Florida. How can this community now come together with this incident creating more divisions?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot that's going back and forth now where there's a very legitimate public debate happening right now is what were the specific circumstances that led to this individual taking this action? Again, our divisive society and the divisiveness in the way that people talk about issues of race and diversity in the public space, I think, first of all, there has to be responsibility taken when language is used that's designed to divide people. But I also think that if we're going to have an honest conversation about what happened and if this community wants to or has to move forward, you have to look at what were exactly the circumstances that led to this to happen, and then how can the community not lose their voice when everybody else is going to want to talk about this and give their own opinion about why it happened or why they were targeted. Let the community be the one to drive the conversation and let them be the ones to say what they need to move on and to heal from this and not dictate it to them.
That was Nicole Ondahl, Senior Vice President for People and Culture at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis. U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo recently wrapped up meetings in Beijing.
All of the meetings were productive, I'm happy to report. In the meetings, we had candid, open conversations, constructive conversations. I was able to explain U.S. policies and our approach to China, and I was able to hear from them and listen to them.
Secretary Raimondo, one of the latest Biden administration officials to travel to Beijing as part of efforts to strengthen communications, particularly over the economy and defense.
When it comes to matters of national security, there's no negotiation. There is no room to negotiate when it comes to protecting Americans' national security, including protecting emerging technology. But at the same time, there's business we can do and there's business to be done.
David Sachs, a fellow for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, spoke with me about the tense relations between the U.S. and China.
As you mentioned, she's the fourth senior Biden administration official to travel to Beijing in recent months. You know, when President Biden met Xi Jinping in Bali late last year, he clearly wanted to stabilize the relationship, put a floor on U.S.-China relations, and this is a part of efforts to do so. Secretary Raimondo has an interesting portfolio in that she oversees export controls to China, as well as implementation of the CHIPS Act, which is the U.S. effort to build its own domestic semiconductor manufacturing capacity, both of which are worrying to Beijing. So when she's in China, her interlocutors are clearly seeking to roll back those policies and for implementation to be as limited as possible. Whereas I think, you know, Secretary Raimondo went in looking to explain the rationale behind those and why those decisions were made to restrict certain exports to China.
Yes, that is a really good point that you brought up, and just an example of some of her concerns over China's effective ban on purchases, for instance, of Micron memory chips. Really, could you talk a little bit more about that concern of the chips?
Yeah, so as you noted, China squashed Intel's attempted acquisition of Tower Semiconductor, which is an Israeli company, and then they also put restrictions on the purchase of chips by Micron, which is an American company. China also restricted certain rare earth supplies. So those are all concerns of the United States. I mean, I think those are in part a retaliation for moves the United States has made to halt the export of advanced machines that China would need to build its own domestic semiconductor manufacturing industry. So that is a huge concern for the United States because semiconductors not only power our lives and the electronics we use every day, but they are also key for quantum computing, AI applications, as well as military hardware. So the Biden administration has really, I think, locked on to semiconductors as a key element of U.S.-China competition and has sought to really restrict China's ability to build cutting-edge semiconductors. So that is really, I think, one of the top concerns of the Chinese that they're going to lodge, but I don't see the Biden administration's policy changing as a result of this meeting or any other meeting on that front.
The U.S. has concerns regarding U.S. businesses operating in China. What are some of those concerns?
So these range from, you know, the things we've been hearing about for decades, like intellectual property theft or forced technology transfer from U.S. companies to their Chinese partners. But there are also broader fundamental issues in terms of market access. So there are whole swaths of China's economy that are closed off to foreign competition. That is a big issue for the United States, especially in the financial sector. And there is a broader concern as well about not having a level playing field in China. There is preferential treatment given to Chinese companies, especially state-owned enterprises, and that makes it much more difficult for U.S. firms to operate in China. Potentially, there's an opportunity here because China's economy is doing poorly. It has struggled to exit zero COVID. There are some reports that the economy is even entering a deflationary period. So potentially, the United States has some leverage here to push for more opening of China's economy. But these are long-standing issues that haven't been able to be resolved for years, if not decades.
Also, Republican leaders want President Biden to take a more aggressive stance towards China. What is Biden's policy with China at this time?
That's a good question. I think that the Biden administration's top priority for U.S.-China relations is just to seek some form of stability. The Biden administration wants competition with China, but it wants managed competition with what are often referred to by officials in the administration as guardrails. That essentially, even if we are going to compete on the cutting edge technologies, on semiconductors, AI, and quantum computing, that it doesn't veer into a conflict or a military confrontation. So I would say that the preponderance of effort from the Biden administration has been on things like crisis communications channels, trying to pursue military-to-military dialogue and hotlines. But frankly, to this point, they haven't really gotten anywhere with the Chinese because the Chinese believe that it can manipulate this to its advantage, that basically if there are guardrails or certain rules of the road in U.S.-China relations, that the United States will view it as a pass to act more recklessly and do more things that China doesn't like. And if the risk is raised, then the United States will back off. I think that's the Chinese hope. But, you know, Secretary Blinken, when he kind of outlined the China policy of the administration early in its term, he talked about competing with China, confronting China where we must, and cooperating where we can, using that as the framework. The Chinese, though, disagreed with that framework because they believed that it put too much emphasis on competition and not enough on cooperation. So, you know, I think that one of the core issues here is that we don't even have an agreement to compete. For the Chinese, that is still not something that they endorse as a principle of U.S.-China relations.
That was David Sachs, Fellow for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. The children's advocacy organization Save the Children says casualties in Ukraine have increased over the past 4 months at a rate 7% higher than the previous four-month span. June was the deadliest month for children in Ukraine so far this year, with 12 children confirmed killed and 45 more injured. The organization says the vast majority of casualties were attributed to missiles and drones being fired at residential areas. Katerina Litvinenko is the Save the Children Ukraine Advocacy Manager. She spoke with me from Kyiv about the increase in child casualties.
Yes, so we are seeing that this summer there is a 16% rise in specifically the child casualties in Ukraine. So over the last 18 months, there were more than 500 children that were killed and more than 1,600 that were injured. And specifically, June of this summer was the month where we're seeing the biggest toll on children. It was the deadliest month of 2023, with 12 children killed and 45 children injured.
I understand a vast majority of children have been killed or injured by explosive weapons, including artillery, missile and airstrikes, and loitering munitions, also known as suicide drones, since the start of the conflict there in Ukraine. So why are these types of weapons being used in heavily civilian population areas, such as towns and villages?
Indeed, this is what we are observing. The conflict is not isolated to battlefields. 95% of air and drone strikes from May through August hit populated areas, and attacks in populated areas, of course, hurt children the most. Not only do they affect the residential areas, but these attacks target schools, they target hospitals, so the very places where children should be safe. And because we want to provide spaces for children where they can be safe, Save the Children runs digital learning centers and helps repair shelters and schools. So we provide them with spaces where they can be safe and continue to learn, even during when there are air sirens happening, so that they're in safer places.
And how is the war in Ukraine affecting children psychologically?
Of course, it affects adults and it affects children. I myself am in Kyiv right now as well, and it's been a difficult 19 months for me psychologically, but for children specifically, they are young, so they experience the war at a very crucial stage in their lives, developmentally, and it's important to, of course, safeguard them from that. But that said, children are also resilient, and they are able to go through their days, want to study, want to see their friends. I mean, we work on the ground, we work with children directly, and we hear stories and firsthand accounts of children going down to the shelters and kindergartens with their teachers in the form of play. So for instance, they go down to a cave when an air raid siren sounds so that it minimizes the psychological effect, minimizes the fear, but they still can go down to a place where they are safer and they can play and make it into a more sort of engaging situation.
Yes, as you say, you're there, you're on the ground, you're able to talk with children, and you've experienced some of the things that they're going through. So what is their outlook on life living in this type of situation?
Yeah, we speak to kids, we speak to families on the ground. Just this past weekend, there was an attack in Chernihiv during a religious holiday. It was a big attack, and a six-year-old girl was killed as a part of it, and 180 civilians were injured when a missile hit a big theater. There was a lot of people there. And we spoke to a woman who we're supporting, who told us a story of her grandson. He was home alone, sleeping, when a missile hit an apartment block in their neighborhood, and their home was badly damaged. But he survived. He was terrified, of course, but he was able to share that. And Save the Children does work with kids to provide them with mental health support so that we're able to have a conversation with them so they can talk through the experiences that they have, so they can share emotions with us, with mental health professionals. That helps them to work through the experiences and, as I said, to be more resilient in these situations. But it is horrifying to see that attacks are increasing and more children are casualties of these attacks.
And also, can you tell us about the displacement of children? I understand there's a large population of displaced children. Maybe over 1 million have crossed into neighboring countries as refugees, and 2.5 million who are now internally displaced inside Ukraine. So what is being done to help these children?
You are correct. Millions have been displaced internationally. Millions have been displaced within the country. One of the important things that we are doing is ensuring that they continue to study and have access to education. This is something that creates a ritual for them, creates peer bonding, and creates resemblance of normalcy. We want to make sure that they have as much access to face-to-face education. And so we build shelters, we renovate damaged schools for children to be able to go back to their friends, their teachers, and to the study process. But also for those who are displaced to areas that are not safe, where there is no access to safe schools, we ensure that there is online education process. So digital learning centers are centers that we set up for children in areas where there are no schools. So they can go in, they can do their homework, they can do arts and crafts, they can, again, talk to their peers, spend time together, as well as providing children with devices. About a third of children across the country don't have access to their online education because of lack of devices. It may be multiple children in the same family and only one device. So we provide tablets, we provide devices so that they're able to continue with their process and relieve that burden on the families and the parents in the meantime.
That was Katerina Litvinenko, Save the Children Ukraine Advocacy Manager in Kyiv. That's all the time we have this week. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more issues in the news. Until then, I'm Kim Lewis.